This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. During the month of June, Vermont Edition is running a special series featuring the five major party candidates for governor. We're talking to them about their vision for the future of Vermont and how they would deal with a number of critical issues. And our series continues today with Democratic candidate Matt Dunn. Matt Dunn has served in both the Vermont House and the Vermont Senate. He was appointed as the director of AmeriCorps Vista by President Clinton. And until recently, he was the head of community affairs at Google. Matt, welcome to the program.
Bob, great to be back.
You can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. Give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. What are some of the most important issues for you during this gubernatorial campaign? Let us know at 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. Or just give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Let's start off talking about taxes and Vermont's overall tax system and tax policy. The state relies very heavily on the personal income tax, the sales tax, the rooms and meals tax to help pay for the state's share of the general fund budget. As governor, would you support efforts to change this current balance of taxes? I mean, for instance, would you support efforts to expand the sales tax to include services?
So I think we need to look at the overall tax system in the state of Vermont in the context of where we're going as an economy. And that's really important. And when we do that, I'm going to be looking at one thing, which is, are we basing the way that we pay for our services on ability to pay? That's what I've done in my entire career. I think people can universally say that the value of your property, for instance, doesn't reflect your ability to pay. And that's why I focused on making that change over a period of time and how we fund education. And we need to continue down that track. The other area that I think is important is that we look at taxes on Social Security benefits. You know, I've been talking about this for a couple of months now, and we came out with a specific proposal because I don't believe that middle-class seniors who are living mostly on a fixed income should have their Social Security taxed. And so we're proposing to eliminate income tax on Social Security benefits for middle-class Vermonters. And then the rest of the tax code should be looked at in a broader context. And I think we have an opportunity to do that with a new governor, new lieutenant governor, new leadership in the House and Senate. Go back to perhaps the Blue Ribbon Commission that was brought together, I think it was 6 years ago, to talk about what a revenue system for the future might look like. And everything should be on the table.
So if you look at something like the personal income tax, do you think if you want to make changes based on ability to pay, would you make the rates more progressive so that middle-income people pay a little bit less and wealthier folks pay a little bit more?
I think what we need to do is make sure it's based on ability to pay. And I think we have been known as a state to care about those that are most vulnerable and make sure they have a pathway to success. What stuck out to me as we were looking at the taxes in the state of Vermont is that we are one of the few that taxes Social Security benefits. And as most people know, those benefits are actually taxed twice. You get taxed on the income before it has to go to Social Security, and then it's taxed when it comes back. And so that's where I would focus our energy in trying to right-size that. It's clearly a regressive tax, the tax that comes on Social Security benefits to middle-class Vermonters, and I believe that's where we should start.
How much would that cost, and how would you pay for it?
You know, we haven't looked at the total numbers of dollars that it would cost because I think it has to be part of a comprehensive overhaul. And the way that I would pay for it is by adjusting the income tax to make sure that we are covering whatever is lost through that particular exemption. But I believe that it's the right thing to do, that individuals who are on fixed incomes should not be the first that we look to in order to support our services.
And how about with property tax burdens? Would you also shift more of that burden from the property tax over to the income tax?
No, Bob, I had the good fortune of being in the legislature through the 90s and the early 2000s, and was very proud of my record of moving the way that we pay for education towards ability to pay And we need to keep moving in that direction. No one in Vermont who's on a fixed income should be choosing between, you know, covering their property tax bill and figuring out if they have to stay in our state. So we need to continue to move in that direction. I grew up in the town that gave us Herb Ogden, who first put this issue on the table back in the 70s and 80s, and I believe we need to continue in that direction.
I mean, we have income sensitivity now, so for families that have a household income up to around $120,000, they're going to pay their school taxes based on their income, not the value of their property. Does it need to be expanded further?
I think it does. I think it does. I think it can expand even further. I think we also need to make sure that we're covering things on a statewide basis that affect tax rates disproportionately. That's why I believe that extraordinary special ed costs should be covered by the state rather than it's being something that lands on one small school or another. It doesn't do any good as it may stigmatize a particular family, and it isn't good fiscal policy to have the choice of a family to live in one community to have a disproportionate impact on that community.
Let's take a look at the issue of guns. You've called for a Vermont law that it would expand background checks for all gun sales, including private sales. You've also called for a ban on the sale, I think, of military-style assault weapons. Is that correct?
So I've said that I would sign a bill that banned military assault weapons if it was workable. But I believe that the real priority has to be on universal background checks. And, you know, no one in this country can be unaffected by the tragedies that have taken place over the past year, and particularly the horrific events in Orlando. And as a parent who had to answer the questions from my kids, who are, you know, 11, 7, and 6, I want to be able to do something. And in our research, in reaching out to advocates on all sides, I am convinced that what we need to do is to implement universal background checks to make sure that people who are criminals and mentally ill are not able to buy firearms in the state of Vermont. And it's past time. We need to make sure that that happens. And I will look at any other proposal that looks like it will actually have an impact.
So opponents of this are going to say, hey, you know, criminals don't pay attention to this stuff. You can put background checks in place. But if a criminal wants to get a weapon, they're going to.
Yeah, that's not what the evidence shows out there, actually, is that if you have a true universal background check, and that's enforceable, and you are making sure that all Vermonters know that it's their responsibility to do a background check, it will make a difference. And the reason that I believe it will make a difference is that no Vermonter wants to wake up one morning and find out that the firearm that they sold to someone was used in an atrocity. It doesn't matter who you are or what kind of gun owner you are. You want to make sure that the firearm that you may have sold is being sold to someone who will not use it for awful, hate-filled actions. And that's what I believe a universal background check will achieve.
Today on Vermont Edition, our guest is Democratic gubernatorial candidate Matt Dunn. It's part of our special series featuring all five of the major party candidates for governor during the month of June. If you've got a question for Matt Dunn, give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You said in terms of a military-style assault weapon, if it can be done, well, what's your apprehension there? What are the questions that you have?
So the issue is that the definition of a, you know, military-style weapon is very difficult. And it's been a challenge both at the federal level when they attempted to do the assault weapons ban. It's been a challenge as even places like Burlington have tried to figure out if that is a part of the package they wanted to present. And again, we are, I think, pretty united in knowing that we do not want to have a situation where one person filled with hate can create an atrocity. We need to make sure that we are doing things that will work that we can actually get passed and that will make a difference. And I believe that a focus on universal background checks is the right first step. And again, if there is a bill that is passed that's workable to, you know, limit the number of military-style assault weapons, I will sign it.
So there are thousands of Vermont hunters who use semi-automatic rifles during deer season.
Mm-hmm.
Should those be banned?
No. Absolutely not. No. And this is where it becomes difficult because the definition of a firearm is not an easy thing by any stretch. And having, you know, grown up in Heartland, Vermont, where hunter safety was taught in our school gym and where I went hunting with my father, we have a long tradition of hunting. And to jump to definitions like semi-automatic weapons includes a whole bunch of things that people, I don't think, really intend them to include. So that's why I think we need to focus on universal background checks and then make sure we're looking at all options that are out there and not leave anything on the table. I've been very proud of, you know, my hero John Lewis, who's also being joined by Peter Welch and others, by taking action in D.C. because we have to have this conversation. As uncomfortable as it may be, the activities that have happened force us to be having this conversation of what a good pathway is forward. And Washington has become so gridlocked that they won't even allow to have that debate in the people's house. You know, that's a real problem. And if there was ever a place where we could have that debate, where, frankly, we can show the rest of the country that people who may have different views and opinions and a long tradition of supporting sportsmen, it should be in Vermont. And so we need to have everything on the table. We need to have that debate, and we need to come out with solutions that actually make a difference. The other one that I would mention is I think we need to be enforcing some of the laws that haven't been enforced to date. There should not be straw purchases at gun shows. That's something that is, you know, banned federally currently. It should not happen in Vermont because we know, at least from some evidence we've seen, that those kinds of straw purchases lead to guns going into the hands of other people and then out of state. And Vermont has changed, and in no small part because of the heroin epidemic that has changed the nature of violence in our state and situations where firearms are being used as currency for drugs. And we can't, with a good conscience, allow that to happen.
We got an email from Mill in Heartland who wants to talk about education. Mill wrote, "School choice towns across Vermont are under pressure to give up choice and merge with larger K-12 districts. Will you support changes to Act 46 that would allow school districts to retain their legacy of choice while merging with districts that operate K-12 schools?"
Well, and I appreciate Mill's question. And I believe that the mosaic of educational offerings we have in Vermont is one of the things that makes us truly special. And I was very concerned about Act 46 as it was going through the legislature before there was even a governor's race on the horizon. And the reason that I was concerned is that I felt that it was jumping to merging of governance at a 900 pupil number without thinking about that wide variety of educational offerings in schools and school districts. And some of those are ones that allow for really great K-8 schools and then have had, you know, a century of tradition of tuitioning out. And they give up governance of those high schools in order to have those options. And I think that's a fine decision for local communities to make. But I also believe that there is not a cookie-cutter approach to any of this. There are some changes that I think we do have to make, and I appreciate the focus that generated Act 46, which we do have a declining student population, and in some communities that have been talking about merging governance for a long time, a little extra help to allow that to happen, I think was just fine. But I think that if we are jumping to school consolidation, at those kinds of numbers, we're looking at situations where kindergartners would have to commute an hour each way to school. And we all know what would happen to those communities if that happened. So my approach would be to focus on eliminating overhead. I don't think we need 60 superintendents for 78,000 schools. I don't think each school district needs its own payrolling system or its own electronic student records. That could all be done centralized and focus our money on delivering education. And then we can actually look at the state as more of a system and do assisted distance learning and allow for a class that's taught in one location to be taken by one or two students in 8, 10, or 12 other school districts and locations around the state.
So specifically, though, to Mill's question, your answer would be no.
That my belief is that right now the balance is right. And I think we have a good system where some communities that are too small to have their own high school are choosing to tuition out high school, and some who have decided to come together and have one unified school system with more governance is working for them as well.
Today on Vermont Edition, our guest is Democratic gubernatorial candidate Matt Dunn. If you've got a question, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. When we come back, we're going to talk about health care and lots of other issues. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today is Democratic gubernatorial candidate Matt Dunn. If you've got a question, give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Bob in Johnson. Hi, Bob. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Matt. Bob Hoag, Lamoille Ambulance Service. I really appreciate you supporting Bernie Sanders and the way you're talking about it. But the $15 an hour minimum wage is above what I'm being reimbursed to be able to pay my people. Most ambulance services in the state of Vermont not only have to charge the insurance companies, but they also have to charge the towns. I'm not able to. I'm a standalone private ambulance service, and I have no other subsidy. And you, the federal government and the state government, do not pay me enough to pay my people that amount. How do I do it?
So there's a real obligation all the way around. For those who don't know, I believe strongly that we need to get to a $15 minimum wage over a period of time. And I believe that because I believe that no one in Vermont should be working a 40-hour week and still living in poverty. But that's going to take all of us coming together to make sure that that works for our communities across our rural state. Part of that is going to be the state government stepping up and saying that we're going to pay a living wage and that we're going to reimburse at a living wage. And the other is that we do some direct support to Vermont-based small businesses who are going to be absorbing some of this impact. And I know that we can do that because, in fact, if we raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, there will be significant savings in the state budget. Because right now, people who earn less than that receive a whole host of subsidies from the state. And that money should not go just to fill a hole in the general fund. It should be directed at making sure that we're doing right by our reimbursements to organizations that are our partner. It includes the mental health services organizations across our state. It should go directly to small businesses that are based here in Vermont to make sure that they can make the transition and do so effectively without harm and hopefully improving their businesses. And it's also about making sure that we get rid of some of the other benefit cliffs to make sure that when we get to that level, that people can still continue to grow in their jobs without falling behind.
We have this email from Marianne in Linden Center. She wants to know your position on industrial wind farms. There is a candidate in the race, Peter Galbraith, who has called for a ban on these industrial wind farms. Marianne is an early supporter of yours and wants to know, what's your position? Do you support a ban?
So, you know, I want to start from the place that I believe that climate change is the biggest threat, not only to the Vermont environment, but to humanity in general. And we have to be a state that does our part and, frankly, that leads the way because when Vermont leads, the rest of the nation follows. And that's why I'm a strong proponent of getting to 90% renewables by 2050. You know, and I think that wind has to be a part of that mix. Now, Does that mean that we need to have a system that creates anger and consternation throughout our state? Absolutely not. That's not the Vermont way. And we also need to make sure that we do not have a scenario where people believe that poorer parts of the state are having to own the production of energy in order to benefit folks in the rest of the state. So I feel strongly that there needs to be more community involvement, that there needs to be more engagement on the whole in how we do these siting projects. We need to bring science to bear in order to evaluate those projects. And frankly, this is probably the time where we can bring back the idea of a statewide plan. And when they created Act 250, there was supposed to be an Act 200 that would create a statewide plan and help us think together as a state about where we want to do development and where we don't. And I'm hopeful that this issue around renewable energy will actually bring folks from all sides together to finally have that conversation about how do we want to use our precious resources as a state while still doing right by our planet.
Do you support the bill that was adopted during the recent legislative special session?
I do. I don't think it's going to solve the problems for everyone who are concerned about these developments. And I think that we need to continue to be proactive to make sure that we are addressing these issues in a Vermont way.
Let's talk about healthcare for a second. Do you support the implementation of a single-payer system or perhaps the creation of a public option at the state's healthcare website in exchange to provide universal access? Is that the direction you want to head in?
I believe we need to get to universal health care, and I believe that because of the math. We have a situation where the cost of health care is going up in the state of Vermont at a rate of $650,000 a day, each and every day. And it's affecting all of our budgets, whether it's at the kitchen table, it's at the school budget, and property taxes going up as a result, or the holes in the state budget. And I also believe that health care is a human right. And we know that in Vermont because we're not the kind of state that's going to kick people out of an emergency room when they show up. They're just showing up at the most expensive time and at a moment where it hits them the worst in terms of the treatment that they can actually get. So we need to move down that path, and I strongly believe we have to get there. And in fact, I was a co-sponsor of the universal health care bill back in 1994 because I didn't think the math worked then, and it really doesn't work now. But we've got to make up a lot of ground. I think Bernie Sanders has helped a lot by putting this issue front and center and making Vermonters feel comfortable again that we can get there. But we have to rebuild trust. And unfortunately, with the failed website, people lost trust in government in a wide variety of ways, but particularly in this area of healthcare. So what I will do is bring together a team, and I've had experience in the private sector implementing websites, you know, like this, and in the public sector. And I will bring together a team to actually fix the website, make sure we're regaining trust, move us quickly to reimbursing based on public health and not fee-for-service or how many MRI machines you can keep going or how many hospital beds you can fill, and then go to universal primary care to make sure that every Vermonter has a doctor. And then from there, once we have proven to Vermonters that we can make this work and it makes a difference in their lives, both dollar for dollar and in their health, then we can move on to universal health care.
And would you use a payroll tax to pay for that?
I think we would look at all options on the table to make sure we are able to cover it and cover it right. But I think the reason why, you know, payroll tax is talked about most often is that it would replace what most people are paying right now in premiums through their payroll tax. And we want to have as little disruption for folks as we can. And I believe that what they will see is an actual reduction in health care costs and therefore a reduction in their what comes out of their paycheck.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Peter in Hinesburg. Hey, Peter, welcome to the program.
Yes, hello, Bob. Thank you very much for taking my call, and good afternoon, Mr. Dunn.
Hey, Peter.
Hey, so I have a two-part question. I am a recovering heroin and crack cocaine addict, and I have been clean for 2.5 years now. So my first question is, thank you very much. So I'd like to know exactly how you intend to deal with the opiate crisis in Vermont. And also, when I, in my drinking and drugging days, I saw countless times I saw people that have EBT cards or food stamps. They would go and buy $200 worth of food and trade it for $150 or $100 in drugs for their dealer, for their drug dealer. So I'd like to know how you would deal with those problems and address them.
Sure. Thank you for the question. And Peter, thank you for sharing your experience. And again, congratulations, because what you are doing each and every day is serious, serious work. So thank you. The heroin epidemic in our state is absolutely devastating, and it has come on like a freight train. In fact, over the last 6 years, the growth has been unbelievable, and it's no longer something that we talk about, you know, being about them. It's about all of us. I don't think there's a Vermonter who hasn't been affected by it or known someone who's been affected by it. A friend and former colleague of my mom, lost his 22-year-old son over the winter, and it hits very close to home now on a regular basis, and we're at real risk of losing an entire generation of Vermonters. So here's how I would approach this, and I think the first thing you'll notice is that I'm not going to tell you that we can arrest our way out of the problem, because we can't. This is a health epidemic, and we need to treat it as such. The first is that we have to invest aggressively in prevention. If we invested a fraction of what we invested in reducing the rate of smoking, in reducing heroin, we could make a big impact in making sure that young people are not starting down the path of heroin addiction. The second is that we need community organizers on the ground. We need to make sure that the spread of heroin addiction stops going from household to household, particularly in communities that are particularly affected by this epidemic. And I have experience with my work at AmeriCorps Vista on doing just this kind of work and placing people in these communities. And I think there's a national service role to play in making this happen. The third is we have to have treatment beds available for when people have a moment of clarity. Having a 360-day waiting period for a treatment bed is simply unacceptable. We need to make sure that individuals can go, even if they're arrested for something else, if it's clear that they are ready for treatment, they should be taken directly to a treatment bed, and one has to be available for them. And then the final piece is engaging the healthcare establishment on reducing the prescription of opioids. And there's been some recent articles that have come out that have shown that drug companies actually knew that opioids do not make a difference after the first day in pain control, and yet we're still encouraging doctors to prescribe for weeks on end. And that's got to stop, because the overprescription of opioids is a contributor. Opioids need to be seen as the last solution, not the first solution for pain. There are lots of other options that we can use, and some real bright spots for how community engagement can make a difference, like some of the work that's being done in Rutland. But we have to invest in it, and we have to take it on as the health crisis that it is.
And what do you think about the legalization of marijuana?
So I actually believe that we need to move forward with the legalization of marijuana, because I don't know anyone who thinks that prohibition has actually worked. In fact, if you talk to any teenager, they would tell you that it's easier to get marijuana than it is to get alcohol. And we need to move forward in a way that is a Vermont way. And in fact, I think we need to move relatively quickly so that we're not having to react to other states that, as I understand, are planning on putting this issue on a referendum. If we do it right, we will have a very careful and controlled mechanism for actual distribution. We will invest first dollar in prevention and enforcement. And as the parent of three children under the age of 12, my objective would be at the end of the day to have a significant reduction in the number of minors who are using marijuana, because the research does show that there is a real impact on brain development. And so that's what I would be using first dollar on, make sure we get rid of the black market and make sure that we are moving forward with real prevention programs for minors.
Got about a minute left, but what do you say to those folks who say Vermont already has two legal drugs, alcohol, tobacco? It makes no sense to legalize a third.
You see, I would take just the opposite argument, that in fact, if we are able to legalize marijuana in a careful way, not jump into having edibles available and everything else, that we can actually reduce marijuana usage for those under the age of 21, and that it would actually take it out of the black market, where I don't think is a good place, where we're actually, you know, contributing to people who are knowingly breaking the law. Let's set up a structure so we can do it right, learn from other states, and make it happen here in Vermont.
Matt Dunn is one of the three Democrats seeking the party's nomination for governor. He'll be on Reddit with VPR next Wednesday for an AMA, an Ask Me Anything session. Matt, many thanks for being on the program today.
Thanks for having me. You can also see more about our policies on mattdunn.com, where we've laid out our plan and vision for the state.
Coming up next, I'll talk with Deputy Agriculture Secretary Diane Bothfeld about this week's big settlement of a case that affects virtually every dairy farmer in Vermont. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. A federal judge earlier this month approved a $50 million settlement to be paid by a national dairy cooperative to thousands of dairy farmers in Vermont and throughout the Northeast. On average, almost 9,000 dairy farms in the region will receive roughly $4,000 each from this settlement. And with us now to discuss this issue is Vermont's Deputy Secretary of Agriculture, Diane Bothfeld. Diane, great to have you here.
Thank you, Bob. Glad to be here.
So this settlement is the result of a lawsuit filed back in 2009. What are the core elements of this lawsuit?
Well, the core elements were that there was kind of a monopoly on the marketing of milk that was reducing competition. So the National Dairy Cooperative was Dairy Farmers of America, and then the marketing association called Dairy Marketing Services. They work with farmers here in Vermont as well as all the Northeast, and Dairy Farmers of America is a national coast-to-coast dairy cooperative. There were concerns that the dairy cooperative as well as the marketing association had set up full supply contracts with buyers. Dean Foods was also a part of this lawsuit. They settled earlier and were not in this last settlement, but marketing milk to Dean Foods, to bottle, et cetera, it was called a full service contract. No one else sold milk. Dairy Farmers America sold all the milk. There were concerns that that was a monopoly and adversely affecting prices paid to dairy farmers.
So is this the kind of thing that might not have happened 20 years ago because there were more cooperatives dealing with milk?
I think that is a possibility. Certainly there were more cooperatives, smaller and more diffuse throughout the Northeast, but also more bottlers of milk. When I started working in the dairy industry in 1995, I guess that was a while ago, there were 13 to 14 different bottlers of milk throughout New England, and now there's three or four. So it really has consolidated. The ownership is consolidated. And is this an antitrust type of thing? It wasn't at the time when those purchases and consolidations occurred, but that's always been a question on people's mind.
So what does this settlement mean for the average dairy farm in Vermont?
Well, they're really looking at the amount of milk produced from 2002 all the way through 2014. And then there's a $50 million settlement here that will be reduced by attorney fees and any other expenses. So that's not been known yet what those fees will be. And so depending on how much milk a farmer made, they do have to sign up to take part. They would get a payment back that on average should be around $4,000. Any money right now is helpful. Milk prices are low, but it is, you know, really a settlement. But also there's a lot of other activities within this settlement besides the money. They're really looking at having farmers have more information and say in what occurs with this dairy cooperative, Dairy Farmers of America, and the marketing association, Dairy Marketing Services. They're going to have a farmer ombudsperson. So if a farmer has a concern, they have someone to go to that will take their side and work with the cooperatives to finalize any disputes. They're looking at having someone take part in the board meetings as an advisory member when these dairy cooperatives are having their board meetings, and also looking at other areas of dispute. Milk is tested for butterfat and protein and solids content, and that's how a farmer is paid. So if that test is in dispute, that can really affect how a farmer is paid. And also if any milk is adulterated, who's doing that testing? Can a farmer access other testing besides that done at the cooperative? So there's some other things in this lawsuit and this settlement that will be helpful for farmers in the Northeast as well as Vermont.
How important are these non-monetary provisions? Do you think they're going to make much of a difference?
Well, I think part of the concern is that the farmer had very little power in this relationship, that there are very few other places to sell their milk. There are fewer cooperatives than there used to be as well in the region. And so the power imbalance was a question, that if the dairy cooperative said your milk was adulterated, it got too hot, and it is spoiled, and you don't get paid for it. Well, prove it to me. And there wasn't a whole lot of other means to make sure they could get a different test done or an independent laboratory doing that test. So I think that's really trying to rebalance that power between the dairy cooperative and the farmers.
So when all is said and done, do you think this settlement is a fair way to resolve the issues in this case?
I think it does look at the issues that were raised. Another aspect of this settlement is looking at limiting those full supply contracts that Dairy Farmers of America or Dairy Marketing Services are not to enter into these full supply contracts for a period of time. So really that concern around the monopoly has also been addressed. And then this imbalance, concern of an imbalance of power between farms and the cooperative, I think those will make a difference.
You mentioned that this money would be greatly appreciated by many dairy farmers. The summer of 2016 is a tough time. Do we have a situation now where production is up, prices are down?
We do have that situation. We also have an international situation where China's not buying as much dairy products. Over the issue in Ukraine, Russia has put on an embargo and they're not purchasing any dairy products from the European Union. All of that backup of milk and dairy products has decreased the amount that the United States is exporting. So, yes, we're in a situation again of too many dairy products versus the supply and demand is out of balance, so the price is lower. And it's a difficult time to see when that will change. So everybody should eat more dairy, more ice cream, more butter, more milk. But also it will be a long summer for dairy farmers with this supply and demand imbalance.
You know, some of our listeners might be wondering, isn't there a federal price stabilization program in place to deal exactly with these kinds of conditions? And if so, why isn't it working?
Well, there was a major change in the last farm bill. The dairy programs received an overhaul, and some longstanding programs were removed. The other program that has been instituted is called the Milk Margin Protection Program. That's like an insurance program for farmers to ensure the margin between the milk price and their feed price. That has some issues with it. There's a concern that the feed price is calculated nationally, and we have very different feed costs here, especially bringing grain in. And that's part of the calculation. So there are some tweaks occurring. Congressman Welch is taking a hard look at that feed cost aspect and is working on some solutions potentially in Washington, D.C. But it's even time to start having that discussion for the next farm bill. It's coming soon.
Deputy Agriculture Secretary Diane Botfeld, many thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
That is Vermont Edition for today. Tomorrow, our series with the gubernatorial candidates continues. Our guest will be Republican candidate Bruce Lissman. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Sangari, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. We have production assistance from Jake Burstein. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Bob Kinzel. Thanks for listening.